Ladies and gentlemen, sports fans alike, welcome to another edition of Bill Swirsky's Sports Talk Chicago, one of the couple, two, three best podcasts around. So sit back, grab yourself a cold one and a Polish sausage, park your keister in the French room, and listen to Bill Swirsky's Sports Talk Chicago.
In Chicago, you know that all sports rock. The Bears, Hawks, Bulls, Cubs, and Sox. Pick your favorite, you can choose, as long as the Packers lose. For everything you need to know, it's Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago. Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago.
Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago. This is your hosts, Alex and Sean. On this episode, we are going to be talking about the Super Bowl and the Super Bowl as it pertains to our beloved Chicago Bears. We'll be talking the Bulls and Blackhawks and Little Cubs. But first, I'd like to thank our sponsor, the Rockford Ice Hogs. If you're not familiar with the Rockford Ice Hogs, they're the AHL minor league affiliate of the Chicago Blackhawks. What does that mean for you? You could see the stars of tomorrow today at family-friendly, affordable prices. Season is going on right now. Make sure you head on over to icehogs.com, get yourself a hat, shirt, jersey, tickets, and more. Maybe a little something for Valentine's Day for your loved ones. Tell them Swirsky Sports sent you. Alex, how was your Super Bowl experience?
It was good. I had a few guys over to my house, and we sat, ate some food, watched the game, enjoyed each other's company. Nice, simple, but good. As long as you have buddies and good food and a good game, that's all you could ask for, and you got pretty much everything you could ask for, especially with the game. It was a really, really good game, and I know there's a little bit of controversy, but I say it was a really, really good game, and I think the Chiefs deserved to win that game. They really played well in a number of areas, and it wasn't just a game where it was dominated by the quarterback. The Chiefs did a lot of good things to win that game, whether it was, you know, a big defensive play to get a fumble return for a touchdown, or a big special teams play when you had a Super Bowl record-breaking punt return. It was all the little things, and it really made you realize how damn good of a coach Andy Reid is and how much you would absolutely love to have him as your head coach. You saw that team go out there, especially in the second half, and really put a beating on a really dang good Eagles defense. And I will say this too. People should not be shaming Jalen Hurts in any way because he did not lose that game for the Eagles. He played a very, very good game. And you know what? It was 38-35. It was a more of a high scoring affair. You saw both quarterbacks make plays. You saw Pat Mahomes make plays on the bum ankle. You saw Jalen Hurts make plays with his arm and with his legs. Some of which was very Justin Fields-like. You saw some of what he did with the designed runs and you're like, oh, we see Justin Fields do that stuff. And it kind of gave you a little bit of hope. You're like, all right, you see how Philadelphia can execute with some of these plays with a full team around him, with guys that can block, with receivers that could catch, and just a whole better team. And you're like, you know what? If you get talent like this around Justin Fields, you can execute and then some with those same types of plays. So there was a lot to watch in this game.
You know, there was one thing I really took note of. There was one really long Jalen Hurts run, and they came back to it and showed the advanced thing where it showed how fast he was going at different points in the run. Mm-hmm. And at the peak, he hit, I think, like just under 18 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, oh yeah, Justin Fields hit like 22.
Yeah.
Multiple times this season. You're like, oh man, you know, if we could add offensive line and some weapons and then have Justin Fields, who's a better scrambler than Jalen Hurts, man, that would be sick. But honestly, my takeaway from this game was just how big the gap is between these two teams and the Bears.
And oh my God.
And I recognize that the Bears played the Eagles really tough.
Mm-hmm.
Even with a depleted team, they played them really tough. But both of these teams just absolutely elevated. And I mean, look at some of those Dallas Goedert catches.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the throws, just unreal placement of balls. Like that one that I thought it was an incomplete pass because he bobbled it and then stepped out of bounds on that to get that first down. and he ended up getting his foot down. But the way that ball was thrown between two defenders,
yep,
where it was like 4 inches above the near defender, and but too short for the far defender, and Dallas Goedert went up and got it. You're like, these plays, man, it's unreal. The play calling, Andy Reid in the second half danced circles around Nick Sirianni. Facts.
Yes, he did.
I think the Eagles were the more talented team, but man, they had no answer for Andy Reid in the second half.
No, they did not. The Chiefs really dominated that second half. And that was after a half where you're like, you know what? Because I'm sure you could agree with this. It felt like the Eagles had control of the game in the first half. And just imagine if that fumble return for a touchdown doesn't happen.
Right. I mean, the Eagles did have it handedly in the first half. And I think, you know, there was the Chiefs just didn't have an answer for anything. In the second half, Andy Reid's like, hey, listen, I got this. And there was, he did different things with the motion man coming across. There was some fake jet sweeps. I think there even was a jet sweep. There was one where the guy started coming across for the jet sweep. And when he saw that the defense shifted over, he just stopped and went back the other way. And it just, again, it either opened up him, it opened up Kelsey because everybody shifted over and Kelsey winds up wide open for a big play, or Pacheco, the running back, gives him a lane to go in because the edge setter is fearful that motion man is going to trip him up. So he tries to set the edge and it leaves a wide open lane for Pacheco. It was a masterclass in offensive coaching. And the thing is, it's like the Chiefs defense was really struggling, and had they not gotten the time down, I think the Eagles go down and score and win that game.
Yeah. I mean, it's very possible, you know, we'll never know 100% for sure, but with the way things were going, I think it was at least a safe bet they would have gotten points. You know, they probably could have gotten points. Before I get to the controversial call, there's one stat from this game that I think really stands out and I think is really important to take note of if you're a Bears fan going forward, and you might be thinking the same thing. Sean, do you know which team had the most sacks by far in the NFL this year?
Oh, the Eagles.
Uh-huh.
Far and away. They I think they were the third most in NFL history.
Right. How many sacks did they get on Pat Mahomes in this game?
That would be goose egg.
Correct. They did not sack Pat Mahomes once.
And that's huge. That is huge.
I thought you like, I really thought that if you want to watch a playoff game, a Super Bowl, where you want to watch really good offensive line play, I think this was one of those games, because in total, you had 2 sacks the entire game, you know, and again, we're talking about an Eagles team that not only led the NFL, like you said, they were like historically good. They had the most sacks with 70. The next team up, guess what? It was the Chiefs. They had 55 sacks. So both those defenses know how to get to the quarterback, and you had 2 total in that entire game.
Yeah, but you know, on the Chiefs, you had a generational talent at quarterback with Pat Mahomes. You have a generational talent in Travis Kelce, and the offensive line, if you've make it's makeshift over the last 2 years. But other than that, is like Pacheco was what, a 7th rounder. You signed Juju Smith-Schuster to replace Tyreek Hill, and I think he was like a 1-year deal. Like, you make things work with the talent they don't have. You know, you have 2 elite players, and everybody else is just sort of patchwork. That's the amazing part of the Chiefs, is that they're so good at using what they have.
Right, exactly. And Juju had a really solid game. He had 7 catches for 53 yards. I mean, you know, he had a nice game. So he contributed to this victory. And you look at it too, the three touchdown passes were spread out. Kelce had one, Tony had one, and Sky Moore had one.
And you mentioned controversy, and I know exactly what you're going to say. And I'm going to say something different. So let's go with
yours. Do you know what I'm going to say?
You're going to call you're going to say the defensive holding call at the end of the game.
Yes, that is what I'm going to say. But do you know the point I'm going to make? But I want to hear what you have to say first.
Oh, okay. So yeah, the play in question is the holding call at the end of the game. That's not the controversial one for me. Is I don't know how it's legal. The 1 yard run that the Eagles kept doing, like third and one and fourth and one, where they had people in the backfield pushing the quarterback. How is that legal?
We were talking about that yesterday. We're like, the guy's literally like pushing his ass forward. Like you see him just put full force pushing it forward.
You know, there's people that are like, well, you just stop it. How? It's literally, there's no way to stop it, because if you come from the sides to try to, you know, knock him from the side or push those guys out of the way, the play's already done. And you know, what's the next call is to have people push the defensive players from behind. Like, what is this, rugby? They made it. I am sure you remember, I mean, you weren't alive, but you probably have seen the video of carrying Walter Payton into the end zone. That is not legal.
Right.
So why is this legal? And I have a feeling that this is going to come up in the competitive rule changes that they talk about during the offseason. And I would not be surprised if they make that illegal, because it's not fair. I mean, you know, Jalen Hurts is a really strong guy. Really,
yes,
strong.
He is.
Lower body. I mean, he's strong all over, but that lower body of his is super strong. And then you already have a good offensive line with the Eagles. And essentially what happens is Jason Kelce dives low, and the other guys go high, and you have an imbalance, and then you just push him, and it's near impossible to stop, unless the Eagles make a mistake, bad snap, step on somebody's foot. There's no way to stop that. And
you knew
it seems
every
like
time
a cheat code.
You knew every time they were third and one, fourth and one, and they were running that play, you knew they were going to get it every time.
Yeah, it's like a Tecmo Bowl, you know, with Bo Jackson on the sweep. It's a cheat mode. It's cheating. And that's why the Eagles are so aggressive on fourth down, because if they get it third and one, of course they're going to go for it when it's fourth and one, because they've got a cheat code. They're automatically going to get it. So on third, you know, they have like a fourth, an extra down, because they're like, well, this, we're guaranteed to get it. If it's like third and one, let's just go for it on third with a big play. And if we don't get it, we'll line up and do that play and push ahead for the 1 yard.
Yeah. And you know, the Eagles being a really good team, you know, well assembled, they're not going to make the mistakes. So you don't really count on the likelihood of a bad snap or a fumble or anything like that. You know, you know, they're going to execute on that play.
Yeah. So I think that's a cheat mode. And I would not be shocked if that stops. And Nick Sirianni goes for it on fourth down so much because, you know, it's being third and two or less, that happens regularly, especially to good teams. And to have a cheat code where you automatically get a first down, you know, it's like the Packers by the refs. The Eagles have that cheat mode of the push. So it's not flattering. And I'm curious of how aggressive Nick Sirianni would be if that was not allowed.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you brought that up, because I wasn't sure when you said you were going to bring something up. I was wondering if you were going to bring up the bobble catch or even the fumble return for a touchdown that was called back. That was really, really close.
I agreed with the fumble that was called back. Agreed with that one. I still, I watched on the projector and not on the TV that has better resolution. But that bobble catch, I still don't think that was a catch. I don't think that left foot was down. The first foot was down when he had possession. But you know what? It was too close for me to call. But going back to your point with the play where Bradberry got the defensive holding call on Juju Smith-Schuster, that was the topic you were going to bring up, right?
Yeah, and I mean, my whole point with that is he grabbed him.
Yes, he did. Thank you.
He did grab him. He did grab him. I hate that that's called. I hate it. You can't tell me that jersey grab impeded catching that ball in the end zone. It was too far off. I believe it was too far off. I could rewatch it. I can do it. But he did grab him. I'm not going to deny he didn't grab him.
That's where pass interference and the defensive holding differ, is that would not justify pass interference because there was not catchable. There was no way he was going to make that catch.
Right.
It was holding. And the reason I'm fine with that call is the defender got, you know, messed up by a change of direction, and he used the jersey pull to keep him close. And that's why the penalty. And at first, when I first saw the flag, I was like, ooh, I'm rooting for the Chiefs here, but I think that was a bad call. And that's where, you know, the announcer said the same thing. Greg Olson said that. But yeah, when I watched the replay,
yeah,
oh, there it is. That's why I thought it was on that second where with the hand, but it was the jersey pull because he used the jersey to kind of tug and help him change directions and stick with the guy. And that's where the penalty was. It wasn't that second hand. That's a ticky tack, but the jersey pull, if he doesn't do that jersey pull, especially with how bad that field was, I think Juju Smith-Schuster is wide open.
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, I changed my thoughts after I initially saw it, because the first angle they showed, the overhead, I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? He didn't even touch him. And then you see, okay, he did clearly grab him. I just hate the inconsistency. I hate how something that, yeah, okay, by definition, yeah, holding, okay. You've seen so much worse than that not get called. Right? We can agree on that.
Oh, absolutely. And
it's just, it's frustrating. It's frustrating to see that. And it's frustrating it had to happen in such a big moment.
You know, and if people are like, oh, hey, I'm pissed about this because there's inconsistency, I say, all right, I'm there with you. If you tell me that you're, that, you know, whatever, that's, it's, if you're mad that they called that then and not other times, fair. But that was the definition of what the rule is.
And you know what, give your credit to the defender because he owned up to it. He did own it. He didn't try to say that was bull crap, I didn't do anything. You know, on how egregious it was, he did own up to it.
Yeah, he absolutely owned up to it. And, you know, I commend him on that. And, you know, that wasn't what caused the loss. That, if the only thing that did was allow you to run down more time. And
right,
otherwise, right, you just kick that field goal and then you still have to come down. And that would have been a tough sled for them anyway. But you know what? There was calls both sides that were tight, and I think it was a fairly officiated game, which, you know, there was recently a question to Roger Goodell about the officiating, and he's doubled down by saying this was the best season of officiating. And I was like, how can this guy say that? This was some piss poor officiating this season. This season was real bad as a whole. I think this game was fine, But as a whole, this is bad. And especially when, and fans have you poo-pooed these fans like by saying, oh, it's great, because you as a league have embraced gambling in multiple facets. Yep. Through fantasy football, through actual betting on the games, you are well in bed with the betting sites. You're partnered with them. And when you have bad officiating, that has lack of confidence in your product. And when people have a rightful criticism of your product, you should take it seriously.
Yes, and I think that is one of the reasons why people were more on edge with that call, because I think if this is a few years ago, people are going to be very pissed right off the bat because, okay, we all saw the one angle and it didn't look like anything happened. But if you see the next angles, would some people accept it? No, but I think a lot more people would be like, okay. But I think we're all just... we've all had enough of the inconsistent officiating and the last few years of gambling, partnering with the NFL being such a big part of it. We've asked questions. We've really looked at a number of games at seeing refs deciding games, and people are more on edge about that stuff than ever. And then you add Goodell's comments, which just add fuel to the fire. I mean, you now have, even though people do it jokingly, there's this whole, you know, joke now online where, it's part of the NFL script, but I think there are people out there that are like, you know what? I mean, you look at the way gambling is part of the game now, and you look at some of these egregious calls, you know, I can't say anything yes or no what's going on, but I think we have the right to ask questions. And I think because of that, people are more on edge than ever.
And if you're Goodell, what an idiotic answer. It's one thing if you just completely disagree with the people, but you know what? You say, hey, listen, we're always looking to improve every off season. These are the steps we take. We have meetings with the officials. We go through video. We emphasize, this is a catch. This is not a catch. And so we have uniformity around the league. And you know what? People, even whether you're blowing smoke or not, people will believe it. But when you just come out and say, nope, we're great.
No one buys it.
Nobody buys it. Not a soul. There's Roger Goodell's grandma doesn't believe him. She's like, this MF or a lion.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, and again, we want to emphasize that we don't think that the Chiefs were just given a win, because I believe they did deserve that win. Even if you think that call was ticky-tacky or not, they played well enough to win. They were the better team in the second half, and that's when things really matter most. But it just, as a whole, this whole concept of the refs and what they do and where the sport is now, and people are more on edge of it than ever. And I think we have a right to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we also, we do, you know, we obviously have to look at the facts, look at what happened, and, you know, look at the play itself and evaluate from there. But we've seen just a lot of awful, awful calls. And, you know, people are going to look at this game with that play and look at it as a really horribly officiated game, where I actually think, compared to a lot of other games, this was officiated better than a lot of other games we've seen as a whole.
I would agree with that. I think it was actually pretty well officiated, to be honest with you.
It's and you know what? I'll say this too. If that play happens in the first quarter, I don't think a lot of people are talking about it. It's the timing of it too that really, really magnifies it.
Absolutely. But I want to turn the focus more Bears related, and Super Bowl week, something absolutely egregious happened in the NFL. And that is they announced the NFL Hall of Famers and they missed the name.
Yeah.
How is Devin Hester not in the Hall of Fame? How?
Everyone remembers where they were when they would watch him return a kick. And not just Bears fans, anybody will tell you. Like, when you ask any football fan, even Packers fans or Lions fans or Vikings fans, you ask them, who's the best return man of all time? Everyone's going to pretty much say Devin Hester. And this is a sport where you value the player by the position. You know, you as a left tackle aren't going to have the same impact as a quarterback, but a left tackle, the best ones, will get into the Hall of Fame because they're one of the best left tackles out there. You know what I'm saying?
And I mean, this was a pretty stacked class, but still, you put Devin Hester in there. If next year he has to be in, because I'm looking at the class of potential Hall of Famers for next year. Julius Peppers, hands down, he's going in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Antonio Gates, probably going in the Hall of Fame. Eric Berry, possibly. After that, though, it's like Haloti Ngata, Jamal Charles, Brandon Marshall, Josh Sitton, Muhammad Wilkerson, Pac-Man Jones, Sebastian Janikowski.
There are good names in there, but, you know, compare them to the first thing. Like, when you said Julius Peppers, like, that's not even a question, right?
No. So, with that, you're like, man, Devin Hester better be in there. Better be. Because otherwise, things like get a little more rough, because then pretty soon you're going to be going up against, I guess the next year's not so bad either. It's like Luke Kuechly, Earl Thomas, Adam Vinatieri, Eli Manning.
You think Eli Manning gets in his first year?
I don't think Eli Manning belongs in there at all.
You don't think so?
You take away those two Super Bowls, he's a mid quarterback.
Really? You think?
Look at those stats. Look at his career stats.
I mean, I agree he's nowhere near as good as, like, you know, the top quarterback. Like, he's nowhere near as good as Peyton. He's not as good as, you know, Favre or Montana or LA, but I mean, 57,000 passing yards, 366 touchdowns, 244 interceptions.
I mean, quarterback career record, 117, 117. That's it. He led the league in interceptions multiple times. Let's see. Never had over 100 quarterback rating in a season. Most of his accomplishments were just longevity. It's two Super Bowls, but mostly it was longevity.
Isn't he among the very top of, I know passing yards are kind of, you know, debatable how valuable they are, but isn't he among the most passing yards? And, you know, again, I know it's debatable. I know he's been around a long time, but I mean, personally, I think he belongs there, but I wouldn't put him in the first year. I think he will get in just because he's such a big name and those Super Bowls, but he's not a top, very top tier QB of all time. I agree. He's nowhere near Tom Brady, even though he did beat him twice in the Super Bowl, or, you know, Aaron Rodgers or anything like that. But I do think he has a case to be there.
Matt Stafford is going to pass Eli Manning for career passing yards. And does Matt Stafford belong in the Hall of Fame?
I think he's borderline.
I think he's a fine quarterback. He's just, I mean, I'm going to read you off the other names on the all-time passing list. Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Peyton Manning, Brett Favre, Ben Roethlisberger. Like, those are Hall of Fame type guys. But, like, all right, Eli Manning has way more passing yards than, let's see, John Elway. Mm-hmm. John would you ever in a million years take Eli Manning over John Elway?
Probably not. I mean,
what about Warren Moon? Would you take Warren Moon over, or Eli Manning over Warren Moon?
I don't have Warren Moon stats in front of me, so I can't really say.
Warren Moon, I watched Warren Moon play. He was great.
Oh, I know he was great. He absolutely was great. I don't know, have any really numbers in front of me. Well, okay, let me ask you this.
Joe Montana has way less passing yards than Eli Manning. Is there any situation where you would take Eli Manning over Joe Montana?
Well, no. I mean, this is where my question's going to be. How much do you factor in championships when it comes to quarterbacks in the Hall of Fame? Is that a factor to you? Does his Super Bowl, does his Super Bowl accomplishments and those playoff games he won, does that factor in to the Hall of Fame decision of an NFL quarterback? You could say not so much for a number of positions, but when it comes to the quarterback,
are you asking Sean Hotman's opinion, or are you asking me what I think voters will think?
I'm asking both. What do you think, and what do you think voters think?
What voters think, absolutely. Those two Super Bowls are what's going to get him into the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Sean Hotman, no, because I lived through the entirety of the Eli Manning era. And there was, other than those fluke runs through the playoffs, nothing screamed Hall of Famer to me ever. Not ever.
Breaking news, Sean Hotman had his cereals pissed in by Eli Manning. He just walked into your house, didn't say a word, unzipped his pants, and peed in your Cheerios. I mean, listen, I'm not going to sit here and argue that Eli Manning was a great quarterback. I just think that if you look at his overall career and you look at what he's accomplished, I think there is a case for it. I think that he is going to be propped up more than he probably should be. And there is another factor here among voters. It's the name, the Manning name. That name holds a lot in this sport. Right?
Yeah, it does. It does. And here's the thing. If Eli makes it into the Hall of Fame, which he probably is going to, are you going to see me laying out in my yard, kicking and screaming and having a temper tantrum? No. But the next time I go to Canton and I see his stupid face, I'm going to tell everybody around me, fraud. This guy's a fraud.
That guy peed in my Cheerios.
This guy here, he is a fraud. I don't like him. With the cut of his jib.
Yeah, you know, there's another thing too that's very difficult about Hall of Fame quarterbacks is the eras, right? Like, if you compare Terry Bradshaw to his numbers compared to a modern star quarterback, it's going to look like shit. But back then, it was very different. Plus, Terry Bradshaw had those championships. But I think that there is something to be said about evaluating the era in which you played in when it comes to championships. Like Joe Montana, for example, he might not have those passing yards, but what does Joe Montana have? How many Super Bowls did he win? Three or four?
I think three.
Because it was...
Maybe four.
Was it... Because did he... Yeah, he won four and Steve Young won one with the 49ers. And listen, like, I'm not saying that's the only reason he's in the Hall of Fame. Like, don't get me wrong. But look, Eli Manning threw for more yards, and let me compare the numbers here. Like touchdown passes, you look at touchdown passes in his career, Eli Manning threw 336. Joe Montana, on the other hand, threw 273. But he played in the 80s. And style play was a little different in the 80s. You know what I'm saying? Different times. Yeah. Because if you look at the numbers and you look at the completion percentage, Joe Montana led the league in completion percentage four times. In those seasons, he was throwing for like 3,500 yards at the most. Today, that wouldn't be seen like a big deal. back then it was a little different. So, you know, there's so many different angles you can look at with evaluating quarterbacks. And you know, sometimes the numbers are skewed in a good way or a bad way. Your numbers could look worse with a bad team around you. They can look better with a great team around you. You have somebody throw a 5-yard dump pass, and that target, whether it's a receiver, tight end, whatever, they take off and get another 40 yards. Well, that's going to go as a 45-yard pass. That's 45 more yards on your passing career when you really only threw the ball 5 yards. So it's that balance act, because I don't think you could just look at passing yards and determine how great a career was, but I also don't think you can totally just dismiss it as irrelevant. Like, I don't think the passing yards Eli Manning has makes or breaks his Hall of Fame. It doesn't automatically make him one of the very best to ever play, but I also don't think it could be ignored either. It's that whole balancing act.
Yeah. So I'm going to say, all right, you're right. You can't compare eras, but you can compare quarterbacks by other players that played at the same time as them. And to be the best in the Hall of Fame, you should be better than almost every other player in your position, right?
Of course.
All right. Quarterbacks that overlapped by a lot with Eli Manning. And you tell me if they're better or worse than Eli Manning.
Okay.
Aaron Rodgers.
Yes.
Peyton Manning.
Obviously.
Tom Brady.
Overall, yes. Not in the Super Bowl, but overall, yes.
Drew Brees.
Yes.
Brett Favre.
Yeah, even though he's a wanker.
Kurt Warner.
You know, Kurt Warner in his prime was really, really good and obviously the greatest show on turf, but I actually might go Eli Manning with that one. I mean, in his peak, he won 2 MVPs. Kurt Warner in his peak when he was 28, 30 years old would be Kurt Warner. But overall, I'm a little iffy on that one.
Okay. Russell Wilson.
Well, I think for a few years he was, but I don't know. Things are falling pretty hard now.
What if he bounces back to the numbers that he put up?
If he bounces back, I will say Russell Wilson, and I do think Russell Wilson has the really nice peak in him. I feel like I need to see Russell Wilson's complete career.
Okay, Ben Roethlisberger. Silly, but Ben Roethlisberger.
As a player, probably take Big Ben.
Mm-hmm. All right. Take away the 28-3 game, Matt Ryan.
Well, you know, again, that's one thing where I look at Matt Ryan. I'm like, you know what? In his prime years, in his absolute peak, I would take Matt Ryan. And you know what? Matt Ryan's overall stats, you know, you look at the passing yards, they're really, really, really dang good. I don't want to take anything away from Matt Ryan. He also had some really good weapons. I'm tempted to say Matt Ryan. I think numbers would say Matt Ryan. I just don't think that's. I'm probably going to go Matt Ryan here.
Okay,
I will go Matt Ryan.
Matt Stafford.
I feel those are kind of close. Maybe the numbers say otherwise. Let me look at Matt Stafford. Yeah, I mean, Matt Stafford was really good at the passing yards. Touchdowns, yeah. Yeah, I mean...
What about Philip Rivers?
I'd put Eli on that one. Philip Rivers puts up the stats, but he never won anything big.
Rich Gannon. Look up Rich Gannon's numbers.
Let's look up Rich Gannon's numbers. Let's see. 180 touchdowns to 104 interceptions. No.
Carson Palmer.
I got to look up his numbers too. I mean, I obviously remember him playing. It's just Carson Palmer.
Michael Vick.
Vick was a very different quarterback. He was much more gifted physically.
All right. Were there enough quarterbacks that overlapped by multiple years with Eli Manning that are ahead of him that you say, all right, maybe he's not a Hall of Famer just out of sheer volume?
Well, yeah. And I mean, listen, I will admit that on some of those, I was kind of making it sound a little closer. Like numbers wise, like Matt Ryan, I would probably take Matt Ryan. But here's another thing too. There were a lot of other quarterbacks nowhere near as accomplished as Eli Manning too.
True. Facts. Absolutely.
There were
a lot
of them. And, you know, I like Carson Palmer, but like I look at his numbers, I'm like, they're pretty good. You know, passing yards are pretty good for the amount of games he's played. Touchdown interception ratio is pretty good too. And you know, there's so many more stats and numbers you can look at here than evaluating like Matt Stafford. Like when you ask me Matt Stafford, like that's kind of an interesting one. Cause like, you know, Matt Stafford now is a Super Bowl winning quarterback. You know, that adds, you know, that adds something. It really does. And if you look at the overall numbers, I mean, you can make the argument that Matt Stafford is better. You can. I mean, Eli Manning has thrown more interceptions than Matt Stafford. That's just one thing. You know, you look at the rating and Stafford's got a higher rating, not by terribly much, but he does have a higher rating. So, yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying here. There were plenty of quarterbacks better than Eli Manning, and pretty much all of those, I wouldn't say. I will admit, on some of those, I was kind of fishing a little bit here, being like, well, maybe, but, you know, I feel like in this sport, with this position, with the quarterback, winning Super Bowls matters. True. Now, if you're a great quarterback, like if Brett Favre never won a Super Bowl, he would still be in the Hall of Fame because
Dan Marino is the example.
Dan Marino is the perfect example. Yes. There is no question ever that Dan Marino shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. Dan Marino is one of the best quarterbacks to ever play. But when you look at cases like this, where you're comparing, you're like, okay, Eli Manning was not among the very top in quarterbacks in the NFL in terms of talent and numbers they put up. But if you're looking at evaluating some of the accomplishments, I think that championships do matter. And even if it's not determining the Hall of Fame, like you can evaluate the talent of Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady. We've been doing it for years, but we look at Super Bowl wins and we put a lot of weight on that. I feel like we put weight on championships in football and basketball more than any of the other sports, especially with the quarterback position, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, Eli Manning, nowhere near as good as a lot of those other guys we mentioned, you know, but when you're a two-time Super Bowl MVP and you take underdog teams to multiple championships and you do put up the passing yards that you do, I think that does carry some weight, even if that doesn't mean that you were among the very best.
But Devin Hester is so much better than the next best kick returner that it's abysmal that they have not put him in.
Oh, I agree. Terrible.
And if you say, okay, well, you know what? We just don't want to put in a specialist. If they come out and say that, then they better never put another kicker or punter in.
Right. I mean, this is football. There are so many different roles in this game that are essential. Are you going to tell me that you're not going to put bullpen pitchers in the Hall of Fame now for baseball?
Yeah, it's you need these guys to, I mean, look at that Super Bowl last night was partially won on a great punt return. Don't tell me it's not important. If it wasn't important, why would you have punt returns and kick returns?
Why are their whole coordinator staffs dedicated to special teams?
Yep. There's a reason. It's because it's important. And you can't tell me if you right now said all 32 teams, you could have Devin Hester's kick return ability on your team right now. Devin Hester in his prime, his kick return ability right now. And it would cost you a first rounder. Don't tell me that you wouldn't have most teams be like, yeah, I'm taking that.
Oh, I'd love to have him back in his prime. I mean, how great would that be?
It helped the Bears go to a Super Bowl.
Yeah, it did.
Without Devin Hester, that team does not go to a Super Bowl.
And
you can't tell me that touchdown turn on the opening kick in the Super Bowl wasn't one of the best Super Bowl plays of all time.
It breaks my heart watching that play, knowing that we lost. Could you imagine if the Bears won that Super Bowl? How much more we'd be talking about that play?
Oh, I know. That
it would be there with the Jordan shot.
There would have to be a shoe line, you know, Air Hester. Like it would have, you know, instead of the jump man, you'd have him, the silhouette of him, you know, racing for a touchdown or catching the ball. It was unreal watching the guy play. And you know, you could say, oh, you're a homer because you're a Bears fan. Even when that guy went to the Falcons, like anytime I could have the opportunity to watch him return kicks, I watched because he was phenomenal. And returning punts and returning kickoffs, those are two different skills. They're two different skills that take two different types of player. And he was phenomenal at both.
Yeah, he was. He was the guy that made you sit at the edge of your seat every time the ball went his direction. It didn't matter what stadium you played in, whether it was Soldier Field or on the road, everybody got their cameras out. Back when people had cameras and it was flash bulbs, how many times do you look at the footage of Devin Hester returns from the crowd and you see those flash bulbs going off as Devin Hester gets that kick? Everybody was on the edge of their seat, no matter who you were. And, you know, I know a lot of fans of other teams, even a lot of Packers fans, who are like, yeah, man, Devin Hester, he was awesome. Like, I had Packers fan friends saying, like, man, Devin Hester was a special player. Like, I haven't met a person that was like, oh, Devin Hester, he sucks. He didn't mean anything.
Devin Hester was amazing. And, you know, it just sucked that he was not good enough at a position to... It became tough because he wanted to be paid as a wide receiver, and it was a balancing act. Like, well, he's a kick returner though. We can't pay that kind of money to a kick returner, but they ended up putting him at receiver out of necessity, and he was not a good wide receiver. He never could pick up that offense. He was always out of position. just never was impactful. But as a kick returner, when you just went instincts, just let that man do his thing, he was phenomenal.
Yeah, and I think it was really sad that his final game as a Bear, his final games had to be that 2013 collapse at the end of the season. Just a really sad way to go out, but we'll always remember all the good things that he did in Chicago.
Absolutely. But now that the season's over, there's some important dates that are coming up that are going to, you know, have fans' interest. The first one is the NFL Combine starts in like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, the Combine isn't as cool as it used to be when I was a kid because everybody came to the Combine. Now the top players don't come to the Combine, which is fine. But you start to see, hey, this guy has a lot of cool traits. This guy is way faster than we thought, or this guy's way slower than we thought, or this guy is really strong or jumps really high or is really athletic. And you start to see these traits and you'll see guys rise and fall because of that. And you know, I don't know if I take a ton of stock in Underwear Olympics, but you know, you do start to see traits that are important to you. Like the Bears on defense are looking for a lot of guys that are athletic and lean. And so you could see, you watch the guy in film, but then when you see him with measurables, oh, this is how fast he is. This is how, you know, is how lean he is or how high he jumps, how explosive he is. And then you can start taking those traits along with what you're seeing on film and couple those together to project what you think he'll be in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fun. It's fun. You start to see guys, you know, look good. And then after that combine, you'll start to see the pro days pop up. And that's where you'll see the best players at their pro days. After that, March 7th, my watch is yelling at me. March 7th is the date that you have to franchise players. It's the deadline you can franchise tag a player. That's going to be important because, sure, there's a ton of guys that are unrestricted free agents for the Bears to sign, but a lot of them are going to be either extended or franchise tagged. Which is, you know, so the Bears will know after that date officially who will be available for them to sign. And then as we're recording this, 1 month from when we're recording this, March 13th is when the legal tampering period opens up. So 3/13 to 3/15 is that tampering window when you can sign guys before free agency opens. And that is, my friend, is when we're going to see the Bears make some moves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Sirski. And it's going to be wild on Twitter, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. And then the NFL draft is 4/27 to 4/29. So we have a long way to go before that draft. But man, we are getting closer and closer to free agency. And it's funny, that free agency period is, you've got a good month and a half between the frantic portion of free agency and the draft. So when you're the Bears, man, you really have a long time once you throw all types of money around and then have to draft. So, mm-hmm. And I was doing a little number crunching on over the cap, and I saw an anonymous agent say that he thought David Montgomery and the Bears were matched for each other, that David Montgomery meant more to the Bears than he does to other teams. And the Bears might want to re-sign him as a, hey, you know what? We got rid of so many players to show, hey, we do sign our own guys. We do re-sign them. We don't just cut everybody. And they thought of a fair market value would be 3-year, $19 million with $14 million signing bonus. I threw that into over the cap and I cut Whitey Cotehair and Al-Qadeen Muhammad. And I wind up with $98 million. So that's a lot of room to play with.
It is.
And, but they got a lot of holes to fill. I mean,
yeah,
it's kind of unreal. The holes that they have, I mean, I'm just going to throw these names here for you. On offense, your wide receivers, the only ones you have on your roster currently, Chase Claypool, Velus Jones, Darnell Mooney, Equanimeous St. Brown, Simba Webster, Dorrys Fountains, and Joe Reed.
Dorrys Fountains is going to win MVP, man. What are you talking about?
Your offensive linemen that you have under contract, Braxton Jones, Whitey Cotehair, Lucas Patrick. Oh, I also had them cutting Lucas Patrick as well. Braxton Jones, Cody Whitehair, Lucas Patrick, Tevin Jenkins, Larry Borum, Kellen Deitch, Jatir Carter, Doug Kramer, and Alex Leatherwood.
Doug Kramer hasn't even played yet.
He has not. The tight ends, Cole Kmet, Chase Allen, Jake Tongis. Quarterbacks, Justin Fields, Trevor Siemian. Running backs, Trustin Ebner, Khalil Herbert. That's it. You don't have any fullbacks. Your linebacking core, this is a good one. You have three linebackers under contract: Jack Sanborn, Sterling Weatherford, and Coney Deng. Cornerbacks, you have Kyler Gordon, Jalon Johnson, Kendall Vildor, Michael Ojemudia, Greg Stroman, Jalon Jones. Safeties, Jaquan Brisker, Eddie Jackson, Elijah Hicks, Adrian Colbert, AJ Thomas. Defensive ends or edge rushers, Trevis Gipson, Al-Qadeen Muhammad, Jerry Green, and Dominique Robinson. And the only two defensive linemen you have in your roster, Justin Jones and Donovan Jeter. You don't have a long snapper on your roster, and you have Cairo Santos and Trenton Gill. A lot of work needs to be done to turn that roster into a winner.
Yeah, remember when we were talking about the talent gap between the Bears and the Chiefs and Eagles? Well, holy shit. That is a gap.
Yep. Yep, it is.
This is going to be interesting. This is going to be a very, very crucial offseason because you don't have room to get a lot wrong. Not because you might not be able to stock up on picks with trades or have plenty of money to sign guys, but with the amount of holes you have to efficiently plug a lot of them to get better.
Right. Like, I mean, you know, some of those holes will get replugged by guys that, like, I think they'll probably re-sign Nicholas Morrow at linebacker. And you're like, okay, barring injuries, they only played a two linebacker system 90% of the time, 85-90% of the time. Jack Sanborn, Nicholas Morrow. Okay, you can live with that for another year. Could you improve over either? Yeah. But could you do way worse? Yeah. That defensive line. Oof. I mean, you need draft picks and money.
Rework that.
Yeah. Your defensive backs, I think you're okay.
I think so too. I think you need depth, but I think your starting guys are good.
I mean, I liked what Jalon Jones had to offer. Obviously Jalon Johnson and You know, you had your, and in the safeties, Eddie Jackson and Jaquan Brisker. I think you need a little safety depth, but you've got guys. And defensive line, complete overhaul. Wide receiver, you need to add one piece, one top end piece. Tight ends, probably need to add another tight end. But offensive line, and if you sign David Montgomery, that probably, you still probably draft another running back late. Fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh round.
I would think so, yes.
But that offensive line. And so, you know, there is room to get better here. And the hard part is going to be building. You can build the front end depth, but building the, like the front end starters, building the depth is going to be hard and take a while.
Yes.
And so the Bears, could the Bears be good next year? Certainly. But I guarantee they can't be good without being lucky as well.
They they'll
have to have health on their side to be good.
You need health on your side. You need some of just the normal breaks you get in a football game go your way. I mean, there's a lot that happens from season to season when it comes to the NFL. And a lot of it, like you said, to your point, is health. Not only health on your team, but, you know, maybe you catch a team with top guys that are unhealthy, whoever you play, however you play them. And if you get a right bounce, well, you can be a few right bounces from being, you know, a 5-2 team versus a 2-5 team, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
And I think too, it's going to be a real test about how Ryan Poles identifies talent, because one thing that you see from good teams is picking up the guys, just the random dudes that you are able to plug in and make them work. Even if they're not high paid, big name starting guys, if you find depth guys that are able to execute and be part of your team in a positive way, that's going to be huge for the Bears, because you don't have that depth and you're going to have to scrape and try to find some of it somewhere. And it's going to be a test on how well you scout that kind of stuff.
And then you have a big asset with that number one pick and not needing a quarterback.
Right.
And I'm hearing everything as far as maybe the Bears will keep it if they don't feel they're getting value for trading it, then the Bears keep it and draft a guy that they feel is elite.
Well, and that's the thing too, is like, you can look at this situation and say the very worst case scenario is if you don't get a trade deal, you can get whoever you want. It doesn't matter about where they are. You have the first pick. There's no limitation. Everybody is on the board.
And I don't know about you. Like, I would not want I would want to have the number one pick, but I would not want to make the number one pick.
I don't want the Bears to have to make the number one pick. I don't. I'm just saying, like, if you absolutely had to, you know, at least you can look at it from a bright side, even if it's not ideal.
It's just the sheer pressure of everybody. Like, all right, could you name the number four overall pick from 3 years ago?
Probably 3 years ago.
It's hard. Everybody knows who the number one picks are by year.
Right.
And so it's, the pressure is always there. Everybody looks at it right away. You know, it's that guy's a bust. That guy's a bust. You know, and so it's really a lot of pressure for the player, for the team. And I just don't want to make that number one pick. I would much rather Like Trayvon Walker was the number one pick last year. Did he play okay? Yeah. Did he play elite? No. Trevor Lawrence looking good. Joe Burrow looking, I mean, it's very polarizing. Joe Burrow looks really good. Kyler Murray, people beat on him. Baker Mayfield, tough one. Myles Garrett, good one. Jared Goff, they beat up on. Jameis Winston, beat up on. Jadeveon Clowney has been one that's gotten probably more praise than he's deserved. Eric Fisher, very good. Andrew Luck, very good, very short career. Cam Newton, very short, good career, but was very good when he was good. Sam Bradford, bust. You know, you just, there's not a lot of middle ground. Jamarcus Russell, bust.
Well, it's one of those things where we've seen a lot of first overall picks have solid, decent careers. We're like, okay, he's a solid player. He did a decent job, but it's not looked at in the same light when you're the first overall pick. If you're not great, then you're not going to be looked at through the same lens as a guy who was taken in the third round. Like, oh, that guy's a nice, solid player. Good for him. Whereas you have a solid career from the first overall pick, it's going to be looked at very, very differently. And this is a situation, too, that's weird, is because if it was anybody but the Bears in those top five teams that are going to be drafting, you know that they would be taking Bryce Young or CJ Stroud or one of the quarterbacks. The Bears have the first overall pick where the projected first overall pick is going to be a quarterback and they don't need it. How many times have we seen the first overall pick be projected to be a quarterback and the team that needs it or is there doesn't necessarily need it? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Remember when the Colts drafted Andrew Luck? Peyton Manning retired. They needed a quarterback. The Jacksonville Jaguars needed Trevor Lawrence. The Redskins, second overall, they needed RG3.
And here's the history of number three overall picks. Derek Stingley, Trey Lance, Jeff Okuda, Quinnen Williams, Sam Darnold, Solomon Thomas, Joey Bosa, Dante Fowler, Blake Bortles, Deion Jordan, Trent Richardson. You forget about these guys. Do you have an opinion on Deion Jordan?
Mm-hmm.
Trent Richardson? I don't have opinions on these guys. If they would have been picked two picks before, we'd have very strong opinions on them.
I mean, the one I have, I think a lot of people had opinions on was Sam Darnold.
Yeah.
But he was a quarterback and he was supposed to be the future of the Jets and it didn't work out. Did Sam Darnold even play this year?
Yes, he did.
I have not heard about Sam Darnold in a while. Because the last time I checked, he was on the Carolina Panthers.
Yep.
He did play this year.
He did.
He played in six games. I just associate the Panthers with Baker Mayfield.
Nope, that was Sam Darnold played as well.
Yeah, he was 4-2. 7 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. Not awful for them. Just it was only 6 games. It wasn't a huge sample size. But still, think about what Sam Darnold was. Think about the stock that Sam Darnold had to be in New York with the Jets. And it didn't work.
Imagine being the Jets and going from drafting Sam Darnold to Zach Wilson.
And now, okay, I'm getting a little afraid that the Jets are going to massively overpay for Aaron Rodgers.
I don't think anybody's going to give up anywhere near what the Packers want for him.
I don't know. The Jets might be desperate.
I mean, the Packers would have to eat all of that salary.
They would. I just, you know, you give them a lot of draft picks that can help them. See, I'm of the opinion that Rodgers staying might be best case scenario for the Bears, despite him always beating us. But he's getting older. Last year, you know, he was still good, but he wasn't the same guy. And if the Bears were slightly better or played slightly less conservative, they would have won that game against them at Soldier Field. And, you know, he's making all that money. It's going to be hard for them to maneuver around that as long as that money is still there. So it's hard for them to do much if Aaron Rodgers stays. So I feel like it's best case scenario if he does stay.
I'm hoping for it.
And here's the thing. A year ago, I kind of would have laughed. And I know that it's not based on anything huge or the biggest sample size by any means, but for whatever happened this season, something switched in my paranoid mind, thinking, God, is Jordan Love going to be good? And there's been few indications to say that he was going to be anything overly special, but this is Green Bay we're talking about, and it's like you see the parallels between this and the Favre era ending. It's like, oh, well, there goes the fan favorite for many years. Here comes the new guy who sat behind him for several years. Because I don't really know how good of a quarterback in the NFL Jordan Love is, but the dude seems like a good athlete and he might be able to do some things. I don't know. I really don't know. It's that paranoia in me.
Absolutely. I mean, it's understandable.
Like, oh God, is he going to be like a Pat Mahomes Jr. with that athleticism or something?
If he turns into Pat Mahomes, I swear I will just lose it.
Yeah. And like, if like Jordan Love is okay, then fine. I just don't want him to be great and just have yet a third straight quarterback in Green Bay being a Hall of Famer and beating us all the time. I've had enough of it.
Are you familiar with The Onion?
Oh, yes.
Did you see The Onion headline from yesterday?
You'd have to enlighten me.
Chiefs second Super Bowl win proves anything possible if you don't trade up to draft Mitch Trubisky.
Oh yeah, I saw that. And there's been an awful lot lately of Matt Nagy and Mitch Trubisky talk and Pat Mahomes talk with the Bears. I'm just like, oh God, enough already.
Should we move on?
Yeah.
All right, let's talk Bulls. The trade deadline happened, and the Bulls forgot about it, apparently.
Cricket.
Because they did cricket, nothing.
Cricket, cricket, cricket.
Absolutely nothing. And to make it worse, they played the Nets after the Nets traded away Kevin Durant and their trade-depleted
and Kyrie
team,
Irving.
And Kyrie Irving, and the Bulls got blown out.
Yeah. Man, I don't like this Bulls team. I really don't. It's so flawed. The chemistry is off in certain spots. It's so clear where they struggle. You know, you don't have that three-point shooting you need to succeed in the modern-day NBA. You don't have the size to compete with teams like Milwaukee. It was really obvious last year. You're hearing more things about turmoil behind the scenes. I don't know how true they are, but I don't know. Like I liked the Billy Donovan hire, and I'm not putting it all on Billy Donovan, but I think something's not working here. And some of it could be attributed to him. Some of it could be attributed to the roster build. You can only do with so much what's on the roster, but there are things, some in-game things you see Billy Donovan do and you kind of scratch your head. And I don't know how good Billy Donovan is at managing some of these egos, because you've heard Zach LaVine kind of bark back at a lot of his decisions and publicly. And I don't know. There's just, it's not personal against these guys. I just don't like this team dynamic. I really don't.
They're not a well-constructed team. They struggled defensively without Caruso and Ball. They don't shoot threes particularly well. They don't play good interior defense. They don't rebound well.
The offensive rebounds drive me nuts.
and they don't play well as a team. I think individually, there's a lot of parts that would do. Like, I think Coby White is a good player. I think Ayo Dosunmu is a good player. I mean, obviously, the big three are good players. Caruso is a good player. They just, as a collective team, are a poorly put together team.
You have talented guys on the roster. It's just not put together right.
You know, like, you could put together the best motorcycle with the best engine, and if you put, you know, big wheels tires on it, it's not going to win you a race. Like, you've got to put it all together, and they just not a well-constructed team. It's like they just picked a bunch of, oh, this player's good, this player's good, and they didn't put any thought into the construction of the team. And you can say, oh, well, you know, Lonzo Ball was a big portion of the way that they projected this team to play together, and that's probably has a lot of truth to that. But when one guy that's not a top 10 player, top 20 player goes down, the whole team shouldn't just tread water. It's one thing if, like, oh, hey, like, you have Steph Curry goes down. If that rest of that team struggles, okay, because that's Steph Curry is an elite player.
Right. Like, even when the Bulls were still competitive in the early 2010s, when Derrick Rose tore his ACL, you knew they weren't going to be the same because Derrick Rose was the reigning most valuable player.
Right. And they still played way better without Derrick Rose than you probably expected them to play, because
they won a playoff series that next year without him.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, you're like, this is the best you can expect a team to do without their superstar.
Right. Exactly. It's not the case of the, you know, one good missing player shouldn't derail the entire thing, because yeah, it makes your defense worse. And Lonzo Ball was shooting the three pretty well before he got hurt. So those are two things that were lacking on your team, but still, you still don't have the size overall as a team to play the interior defense. You still don't get the offensive boards you need to get. And even though your defense and your three-point shooting is better with Ball, you still don't have enough of it to go on a playoff run with or without him.
And what's next for the Bulls? Oh, potentially, if Russell Westbrook accepts a buyout, they'll sign Russell Westbrook.
The modern version of Russell Westbrook. The Russell Westbrook that hasn't been at the top of his game in, what, several years now?
Five.
I mean, Russell Westbrook was once a really big name, one of the best players in the NBA, but that was a while ago. You know, his days on OKC, that was a while ago now. It was a while ago. And I think that it's another prime example of a Jerry Reinsdorf team seeking out a once big name that's 5 years past their best playing days.
And I get that he played with Billy Donovan in Oklahoma City.
Right.
And they had a bond. He knows what he wants to do. But you're taking on a ball dominant guard to add to two ball dominant guards.
Right.
There's not enough balls.
Right. That's, you wonder about the chemistry, whether or not, if he plays well or not. I mean, the way I see it is it's not, if they get him, it's not going to move the needle much. If they don't get him, you're standing pat. Either way, we're up shit creek. We really are. Whether we get Westbrook or not.
I just don't know what Westbrook brings.
They're going to say he brings a veteran, big name, accomplished player. But really, I don't think it moves the needle to you being legit. At this point of his career, especially.
I'm not going to crap on the move, because they'll probably sign him for, and the thing is, he's not even bought out yet.
No, we're not even there yet.
He got traded and the team was like, you can stay if you want to, you're just going to ride the bench most of the time. And knowing that it's going to cost them roughly the same amount of money if he takes the buyout or if they just have him on the team. So it's going to be up to him whether or not he wants to accept the buyout or sit on a bench. And if he accepts the buyout, then does he want to come to the Bulls? Because the Bulls are going to pay him close to the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the, what, $47 million that he's getting paid this year?
Right. Yeah.
And I just don't know what he does. So I'm not going to say it's a bad move when you bring a guy in that was once a really good player and you're paying him like the minimum. Okay, whatever. But I just don't know what your expectation is if you're the Bulls organization, like the front office. What do you expect to bring him to do to this team?
Right, like my expectation is not much, but when they see it, I almost think it's their way of saying, hey, look, we did something. I think that's very possible how they see it.
I mean, here's the thing. Do I think the Bulls intentionally sat on their hands? No. But the trades weren't there, or the value wasn't there. Did I want the Bulls to make a bad move to make a move? No. But I just feel that you could have finessed something.
I would have started to sell off some pieces, but that's me. I mean, the fact of the matter is you didn't do a thing. Literally not a thing. Even if you would have sold off like a Caruso or a Drummond just to get something in return. You're like, all right, fine. I mean, here's the thing. You still have Vooch. Is he going to walk for nothing now? Are you going to re-sign Vooch next year? I don't think that would be a great move.
I think they're going to re-sign him.
I mean, I could see it. I just don't think it's the right move. I've enjoyed watching Vooch more this year than last year, but Vooch isn't exactly young. And, well, you're just going to try to run things back again next year? What's your plan? We don't know. I don't know. The whole thing is a mess. The whole thing is a mess.
All right. Prognostication time. Is Lonzo Ball healthy and in the lineup for game one of next year?
I don't know. Right now I have my doubts. We're like, I'm no doctor. I don't know the situation, but why would I have any optimism at this point?
That's the whole thing. It's all faith and belief. And I don't have any.
And even if he does come back, he's probably not going to be the same player. He would have missed a season and a half. He hasn't played since
of his prime.
Right. He last played in what, December of 21? Somewhere around there? Did he even play in 2022 at any point?
No.
And you're talking about bringing him back in October of 23.
That'll be close to two years.
Yeah. You can't rely, even if he's back, to be the same guy. It's just not realistic.
No, it's not. And this team's going to have to hit rock bottom before they get better. Because
Again. How many rebuilds have we been through since Jordan? So, okay, we had the Tim Floyd era.
Mm-hmm.
That was a full teardown and it just never went anywhere. Then you had the mid-2000s when you had Heinrich and you had Ben Gordon, and you were competitive. You were never a championship team, but you were competitive. Then you got Derrick Rose, and you had it the only era where you had a shot at a championship post-Jordan. So we'll call that from 2010 to 2015. Minus the years he missed with the ACL, but it was within that range. Then Rose gone, you tore it down, you had 1 year where you're like, you know what? We're going to bring in Dwayne Wade and we're going to bring in Rajon Rondo. Then you tore it down again by trading Jimmy Butler. And then you tried to build around Lauri Markkanen and Wendell Carter Jr. And that didn't work. Not necessarily because of the talent, but because it wasn't coached right. It wasn't managed right. You had the Jim Boylan fiasco. And then you build it again with AK, where you make trades for Vucevic. You sign Caruso. You trade for Lonzo Ball. You sign DeMar DeRozan. And now it looks like you're going to have to rebuild yet again. So I mean, we've been through this multiple times. And we've been fed the same bullcrap a number of times. I mean, Jerry Krause and Jerry Reinsdorf shoving Tim Floyd's teams down our throats. This is a rebuild. We're going to rebuild our way with our vision. We don't need MJ, blah, blah, blah. Didn't they average like 14 wins in the Tim Floyd era?
I'm going to give you. Do you know what the one common denominator in all those scenarios is? Jerry Reinsdorf. It's really hard to build a winning program in the NBA, period. You add being handcuffed by cheap-ass Jerry Reinsdorf makes it a lot harder.
Well, and what really hurts there is the stupid loyalty stuff. How long was John Paxson allowed to be in charge of this team? How many rebuilds did we go through with him? John Paxson came to be, I believe it was that he became the general manager in 2003. So that was after, you know, Krause was gone. Tim Floyd was gone. But you tried this, and it's like, okay, you built something decent in the mid-2000s. You lucked into Derrick Rose. You lucked into Derrick Rose. If you don't luck into Derrick Rose, I don't even know how many playoff series wins we'd have since Michael Jordan. Maybe two total. I don't know, but it wouldn't have been nearly successful. And then you had to tear that down. And then you finally realized after years of just being stranded in the middle of the ocean, this isn't working. It's frustrating. You look at the White Sox and the number of people who have been pointing out the similarities between the White Sox and the Bulls. Ironic, they're both owned by the same person. What's that old saying we say all the time, Sean? It all starts at the top.
Yep.
And this is how Jerry Reinsdorf runs his business. And nothing to me is more annoying than the propaganda. The crap they try to shove down our throats and make us believe it's good. And I truly believe that the days of delusional meatballs are coming to an end. I think people truly realize, hey, you know what? We see a pattern here, and it continues not to work. You tried to shove down that Jim Boylan was going to be good for us. You tried to make us believe that, you know, building around Lauri Markkanen and Wendell Carter Jr. with some convoluted scheme was going to work. Did you really think that bringing in Zach LaVine and DeMar DeRozan, as talented as they are, was going to be worthy of beating Milwaukee or Boston, winning a championship? Or all those years of the Rick Hahn mired in mediocrity teams? Hey, come on out to Sox Park. We got all-star sluggers. We got guys like the rotting corpse of Justin Morneau and Todd Frazier and Melky Cabrera. We are going to make the South. It's all that crap that was fed to the fans. And we're seeing the same pattern. Jerry Reinsdorf and his admiration, his love, his passion for mediocrity. Loves it. Loves 78 win baseball seasons. Loves 40 win basketball seasons. Loves being stuck in the middle. That's all we get from those teams.
Got the TWTW.
Yeah, it's the fans are done with it. The every, you know, Bulls fans. I don't think I've this trade deadline, I don't think I've ever heard the Bulls fan base this angry. I mean that. And we've gone through some crap over the years. We had the Fire Garpack stuff. We had the shirts and the billboards and whatnot. But the anger that you saw Bulls fans expressing after that trade deadline, I thought that was historic. I really do.
I mean, it's just, it's tough to swallow. At a certain point, you just choke. You can't take anymore. It's
right.
It's not one thing. And then you forgot to add in there. Since Jordan, we had one competent coach and they ran him off.
Yeah, you had Tom Thibodeau. I think we did this exercise before where we ranked all of the coaches since PJ. I think we did this on the show before. It was a while back, but we obviously, with Tibbs one, who would be number two? Probably Scott Skiles.
I don't know.
I mean,
do you rank them just on their Bulls career, their whole career?
I mean, as Bulls coach, if you ranked the coaching tenures of all the coaches since Phil Jackson. Okay, let me pull up the list. Let's do this exercise again. I want to do this because this is a good topic of conversation. So, you know, right now we have Billy Donovan, and I think there's a lot of mixed feelings. The feeling when he came in, I thought, okay, we're getting a pretty good coach, and I don't think he's awful, but
you know what? There was voices when the Bulls signed him and he came available that said, listen, he's a very accomplished coach. He knows basketball. There's a reason that he doesn't have a job right now.
Right, right, right. We're not talking about Eric Spoelstra, who is a very, very good NBA coach. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about Steve Kerr. You know, we're talking about a good coach, but not a top of the league coach. I'd say like top third. Would that be fair to say in Billy Donovan, top third, top half?
Yeah.
So, okay, here's the exercise. So here are the guys we've had since Phil Jackson. We had Tim Floyd. We had Scott Skiles.
Mm-hmm.
We briefly had the other Jim Boylan, but he wasn't really, I don't know if you really count the other Jim Boylan much. You had Bill Cartwright.
Mm-hmm.
You briefly had Pete Myers, which, again, that was two games. You had Vinny Del Negro, who was literally 500 in his Bulls career. He was 81 in 81 as Bulls head coach. You had Tom Thibodeau. You had Fred Hoiberg. You had Jim Boylan. And you had Billy Donovan. So Tom Thibodeau's won by a long shot, right?
Yeah, Tom Thibodeau is number one by a long shot.
So number two, you could either put Donovan or Skiles.
I'm going to go Skiles.
I'm going to go Skiles too, because at least Skiles won a playoff series in 2007. So Skiles two, three, maybe three is where I'd put Billy Donovan.
Billy Donovan, probably. And then after that, Bill Cartwright?
Maybe I'd put Vinny just because he did take him to the playoffs twice, even though they were 41-41 in both years. Cartwright only coached one full season with the Bulls. So I'd put Del Negro after that.
Tim Floyd's last, right? No, Jim Boylan's last.
No, Jim Boylan's last. Jim Boylan is way
you're right,
last.
You're right. Jim. Both Jim Boylans were bad.
Yeah. And Tim Floyd is down there, but I am going to be fair to him really briefly. Those rosters are trash.
I say that about Hoiberg.
Somewhat, yes. I just don't think Hoiberg had the leadership quality to lead an NBA locker room. Nothing personal against him. He, to me, is a college coach.
I agree with you. I'm going to rank him ahead of the Boylens and Vinny Del Negro. Tim Floyd.
Oh, I agree. I agree. I would put Hoiberg above the Boylens and Floyd. Absolutely.
I mean, Tim Floyd represented, not only was he bad, but he represented a really bad era of, Bulls in Chicago sports fan history.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you were going from Dynasty, Phil Jackson, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman to 1999. Remember, 98, their last championship. You won 62 games and your sixth championship that decade. You then went to 13-37, which was a brief year, but then you went to 17-65 and then 15-67. As the Tim Floyd era went on, it got worse.
Oh, God, this team.
And then you know what? You can look at the Bulls before Jordan. And early on in the 70s, you had success. You didn't win any championships, but you had Johnny Red Kerr. You had Dick Motta. You had playoff seasons. And then from the late 70s to 1983, you were as irrelevant and bad as you can get. And then you got Jordan. You started getting better when you got Doug Collins, who was a solid coach. And then you brought in Phil Jackson, and then you were winning championships. And then just back to crap. I mean, just remember, since Jordan, we've been to the Eastern Conference Finals once. And we have yet to return to the finals.
That's just tough to swallow.
Yeah. Let's see. How many playoff series have we won? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think we've only won 5 playoff series since. So you won the first round in 2007 against the Heat. That was your first playoff series win since Jordan. It was between 90 after 98. It took another 9 years to win a playoff series. And then you won 2 playoff series in 2011 when you got to the conference finals. 2013, you won that 7-game first round series against the Nets when you didn't have Derrick Rose 4. And then you beat the Bucks in the first round in 15 before you bowed out to the Cavs. That's 5. That's it. Those are all the playoff series you won. And what makes this hard is that there's no end in sight.
There really isn't. I don't know. Unless you just start selling off pieces next year, I just don't see how this gets better.
I don't either. I don't either, Sean. And at least with all the other crappy teams in the city, you see the vision. You say, hey, the Blackhawks are in a very early stage of a rebuild, but you're already seeing where this is going and why they're doing it. With the Cubs, you see them building back up. With the Bears, you know what they're doing. With the Bulls, you're stuck.
Should we move to Blackhawks just quickly?
Yeah.
I don't have much else to say. This is a terrible team, but now it's sounding more and more like Patrick Kane is willing to leave.
Yeah. And you saw the reaction from the Tarasenko trade to the Blues.
Or to the Rangers.
Or the Blues to the Rangers. Yes. Now, and Tarasenko and Panarin, that's quite a...
It's a great line. And you don't tell me the Rangers wouldn't have traded for Kane. But Kane, here's the thing. Kane says, oh, I want to be, you know, fair to the Blackhawks. Then say, I'm open for a trade right now. Don't wait a month.
That would have been more fair to the Hawks.
Yeah, let them trade you. They could have traded you to the Rangers, and you could have been playing with Panarin now with meaningful hockey games. You know, and there's nothing to stopping you from coming back to the Blackhawks next year and playing on a line with Connor Bedard.
Yeah, exactly. So what? You could, if, you know, either you go somewhere else and you stay somewhere else, or you go somewhere else for a few months and you have a shot at winning your fourth Stanley Cup.
It just doesn't make sense. So now that the Rangers are probably out of the Kane running, I would say, after they got Tarasenko.
Right, yeah, right, right.
Who does that leave interested? The Stars? Hurricanes? Wild? Vegas?
Edmonton, maybe, if they have trade assets? I don't know. You always hear about him going back to Buffalo, but I don't know if they're interested in doing that.
Yeah, I don't know if they have the interest. And honestly, I have not heard any rumblings of Buffalo being interested.
I haven't. Not recently. Not recently.
I mean, you know, Buffalo is not that good this year. So it's, do they make a trade trying to make a push? I don't know if they do that.
Yeah. I'm not putting money on that happening.
So it's tough to swallow, but at least they're keeping pace with Columbus in the Connor, or the best odds to get Connor Bedard sweepstakes.
Yeah. So, they had a pretty solid tank loss the other day. They lost in overtime to the Ducks, where the Hawks played a solid game, but you lost in overtime. You're like, okay, that's not a bad outcome. You know, Sean, I said this on Twitter the other day. They're not a good team by any means. But I am surprised at how well they've played compared to where I expected them to be. I really thought that this team was going to be unbelievably historically bad. They're playing harder than I thought. They've been in more games than I thought they would be. I think Luke Richardson's a good coach. I think he's establishing a good work hard culture there. So, you know, it's like they're not a good team, but they're more entertaining to watch than I thought they would be.
Where is this same exact team with Jeremy Colleton?
I think they have at least five less wins. Like that would be historically bad.
If you're tanking, like you're legit tanking, you keep Colleton that next year.
Yeah, right. Hey, come back. You did a great job. I did. Yeah.
But, you know, it's important to get that the number one best odds to get Bedard, you know, because the other spots, it's like 2% difference, negligible. 13.5 to 11.5, 11.5 to 9.5. Moving one spot, negligible. But it's a big jump between that worst spot and the second worst. And I don't know if the Blackhawks are bad enough to get it, because they have less points than Columbus, or more points than Columbus. And they've got two more games, or they've played, or they have to play two more games than Columbus. So, and we're really run out of real estate here. I mean, what do they have, like 25, 27 games left somewhere on there?
Yeah, give or take.
And they need Columbus to win some games.
Yeah, we do. Got to get those best odds.
I mean, I think they're going to lock in one of the top two, but the hope is, man, you sell off Kane, you sell off Taves, you sell off anybody that's not nailed down, and then you really go into tank mode.
Yeah, that's, And boy, if you were able to get some more first round picks over the next 2 years, when you already have multiple and over the next 2 years, boy, how big would that be?
Two firsts, two seconds, two thirds in the next two drafts. And you can add to that.
Oh, yeah.
Last thing I want to talk about briefly is the Cubs. As we're recording this, pitchers and catchers reported today.
Have you seen Seiya Suzuki?
I have not.
Go on Twitter and look up the pictures of him.
Did he pull a Nico Horner transformation?
He is jacked.
Seiya Suzuki. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He did pull a Nico Horner.
I am really hoping that we get the over on 25 homers from him this year.
But yeah, pitchers and catchers reported, position players report in a couple of days. Andrew Chafin signed elsewhere, but they did bring in Michael Fulmer, who a couple years ago, this would have been a huge signing. I don't know what Michael Fulmer we're going to get now, but,
as I think this is a good move.
I think this is a low risk, high reward move. I can't imagine he signed for much. So
it's a 1 year deal.
And when he's playing well, he's a really good bullpen arm.
He's got a big arm, lively. He can miss bats. The big knock is that, you know, his command isn't always the sharpest, but if you look at what he did the last 2 years, if you combine the stats of 2021 and 2022, they read as the following. So this is 2021, 2022. He pitched to a 3.17 ERA, a 3.51 FIP, a 1.3 WHIP, a 9.0 strikeouts per nine, a 3.2 base on balls per nine in 133 and a third innings. It's pretty solid. 134 strikeouts and 133 and a third innings.
My concern is which hand does he pitch from?
He's a righty.
The Cubs could have really used a left-handed arm.
Yeah, I know. And I know that right now, I think our only projected lefty in the pen is Hughes.
And I think
that's it.
The Astros have shown that you can win with an all-righty bullpen, but sometimes it's nice to have that lefty coming out of the bullpen.
Sure it is. And, you know, I know the days of the loogie are over. You know, it's a different dynamic. The Cubs are going to go with a more staff-based approach where you have guys that are going to be in your pen that are going to be pitching where needed. I think that there's obviously going to want to be a closer, a solidified closer, but you know, I think there's going to be a big committee of who's going to be closer right now. Michael Fulmer could be one of those candidates. I also think Brad Boxberger is one of those candidates. You might also look at Adbert Alzolay and be like, what's his role? Is he going to be another swing guy? Or do we just say, you know what? You're going to be our two-inning reliever. He's got good stuff.
When does Hoyer return?
That's going to be later in the season. That's still a ways away. But that kid's got a big arm, though. If he comes back healthy, that could be another weapon for your future. But you know what? The Cubs figure this stuff out. They've done a good job the last year of figuring this stuff out. Wouldn't you say?
They do. And I'm not nervous. It's just, you like to see a little bit more balanced.
You know, Moore is still out there. Maybe they sign him. He's a lefty.
I don't know if they're going to make any more moves barring any sort of injury.
I don't know. They might. I'm not saying they will, but if they had a chance to snag Matt Moore, boy, was he good last year. Do you see what Matt Moore did for the Rangers last year?
Yeah.
195 ERA, a 298 FIP, a 10.1 K per nine. The only thing is the walks, but.
That was part of the reason. I mean, it was one of the many reasons that I wanted Andrew Chafin to be back. Lefty, history with the team, good player, awesome personality, fan favorite.
Yeah, and I wanted him back too, but oh well, he went back to the Diamondbacks.
Do we know what the contract was?
I don't know. I thought it was a one-year deal. I don't know any of the details. You know, maybe it's possible that as much as we like Chafin, they just saw the livelier potential with Michael Fulmer, even if he is a righty.
Andrew Chafin, 1 year, $6.5 million.
Yeah, it's not much. It's not much, but for a one-year deal for a reliever, you know, how much should Fulmer get? I don't even know how much. I just know it was a one-year deal.
1 year. Oh, wait. I don't know if we know.
Yeah, because I haven't seen anything. Maybe I just missed it, but I haven't seen anything.
No, I have not seen it.
I mean, either way, I'm perfectly fine with this Fulmer move. I actually thought it was a sneaky good one.
Yeah, I'm not mad at it. I just, it would have been, I was just excited for the opportunity to have Chafin back when it looked like it was adding up to that.
Yeah, I hear you.
And the only other thing is I saw a picture or a video that got me excited, and it was Brennan Davis in the batting cage with PCA and Matt Mervis standing around watching him, and then just went, "Woo! This is the future here."
Yeah, I know. It was fun to watch, and you hear those loud pops that you get off those bats. You're like, "Oh man, these are the kids are already hard at work." You love to see it.
And
Kevin Alcantara too. He was hitting some tanks.
Yeah, and to hear PCA talk about Nico Hoerner like he was a veteran leader on the team, you're like, man, he's still a young kid too. Like the future is starting to look brighter and brighter.
Yeah, I think that you're seeing what I see so far is a really good culture being established in Chicago on the north side. And I think you saw that last year too. Even though they were down and out, they still fought hard in the second half. And I think that goes a long way.
Yeah, I think your team makeup is important. You need talent, but I think the makeup of your team means a lot. And sure. I think, you know, there's of the shortstops, Dansby Swanson, talent wise, was probably the one I wanted least. But as far as character and team building, he's probably right up there at the top of the four.
Right. And I'm with you too. Like I was very pro anybody but Dansby early on, but now I'm like, you know what? We might not have gotten Correa. Who knows if Correa's ankles can even hold up at this point. And I was a big Xander Bogaerts guy. We didn't get him. Trey Turner was probably never going to be an option. I think he was married with the Phillies before the offseason even started. So you're like, all right, you know what? Take what you have with Dansby Swanson, because you're still getting some good things with Dansby Swanson.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think playing at Wrigley and in front of that crowd, he's going to be a fan favorite real quick. And
his wife too, playing on the Red Stars.
Oh, she plays on the Red Stars.
Yeah. Mallory Pugh.
Huh. But that's
now Mallory Swanson.
Didn't JJ Watt's wife play for them too?
Was it Watts or was it Ertz? Maybe. No, was it JJ Watt?
I think it was JJ Watt.
It was one of them.
And we always link JJ Watt to the Bears because his wife plays here.
Yeah.
That didn't happen. Never will happen. JJ Watt will never be a Bear.
Nah, he is retiring.
Yeah, so it's exciting to see the makeup here, and and it's crazy to think is look at the rankings of this farm system for the Cubs. Now, just imagine if Brennan Davis comes back to the guy he was pre-injury.
Yeah. Imagine him and like Ed Howard taking that step again after coming back from injury.
I mean, where was Brennan Davis ranked as overall in all of the farm system, like the prospects before the injury?
He was number one.
No, not just for the Cubs, overall in baseball.
Oh, overall in baseball. I believe he was top 20.
I think so too.
And top 30 or 20, but yeah.
You know, you add him back to what he was at that point, and how good does that Cubs farm system look?
Yeah, it makes you look even better, and you hope that this year too, you're getting a real step forward with some of those other guys down there. And you know, right now the Athletic named you number 10, your top 10 farm team. You have really good rankings from Fangraphs. They're pretty high on you. If Brennan Davis returns to form, if Kevin Alcantara keeps growing, and if you see Ed Howard rebound and some of their draft picks from last year pitch really well, like, what was his name? The first round pick, Cade Horton. You see them play really well, the farm's going to grow even more, going to get ranked even higher.
Yeah. So it's fun time to see.
It is. And as we were talking just these last few minutes, I got Matt Mervis highlights on my screen. It is unreal how far he hits some of these shots. And like the it looks so effortless. And I just hope it translates to the major leagues.
I know a certain first baseman that's probably watching those videos and going, damn it. Damn it all to hell. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, I've said my piece.
Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode of Bill Swirsky Sports Talk Chicago. I want to thank everybody for listening. Please hit subscribe however you listen to podcasts, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, Google Play, Spotify. Share this podcast with your friends. This is how we grow the show. Follow us on social media at Swirsky Sports, facebook.com/SwirskySports, SwirskySports.com, ShyFanPat2 for Alex on Twitter, or AlexanderJPatCreative.com for all the cool stuff that Alex does. And again, thank you guys so much for listening. And until next time, bear down.
Cubs win! What a lucky break! The good Lord wants the Cubs to win!
We thank Ditka and God for all they have provided.
Cubs win! Cubs win! Cubs win!
Oh, I don't want her. You can have her. She's a Packer fan. She can't fit in my van.
And she looks like...
Remember, New Yorkers, smoking crack is not legal on planes.
Bears 31 to negative 7.
The Bears!
Oh, when the Bears go bearing down...